Malcolm's greatest contribution to us is to think for ourselves, to learn to help ourselves when others refuse, and to demand a world in which such help is not the preserved of the privileged, but the domain of the masses. With the broad humane vision that powered Malcolm's final days, African-American life can surge forward against the incredible odds we presently face. By our willingness to think and do the impossible, in the name of the inextinguishable hope that moved our ancestors to dream and act with great boldness, we too can triumph, like Malcolm, by any means necessary.
Critic Michael Eric Dyson, he'll be back in just a moment to talk about his new book, Making Malcolm, a study of the life and legacy of Malcolm X. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part three in a series of discussions for Black History Month 1995. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. In February, we celebrate Black History Month, a time when the nation recognizes the contributions of African Americans to our common culture. But this month also reminds us of one of the tragic chapters in African American history. It was 30 years ago, in February of 1965, that Malcolm X was murdered in New York City. At that time, Malcolm X stood for black nationalism and existed on the margins of American politics. Today, he's an icon in the cultural mainstream. Throughout that transformation, he's been one of black America's most controversial figures, a man whose reputation is subject to constant revision. Listen now as a leading commentator talks about Malcolm X and his influence on leadership in the African American community. Michael Eric Dyson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is Making Malcolm, subtitled The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. Michael Eric Dyson is also the author of Reflecting Black, a collection of critical essays about African American culture. Michael Eric Dyson, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Congratulations on these two new books you've written.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin by talking about leadership and African Americans. You've written a book about Malcolm X. Is he one of your leaders? Is he a national leader for African Americans still?
Sure. I think in many ways his resources morally and spiritually and ethically continue to influence African-American people. His bold, defiant gestures, his rhetoric that was broad and appealing to a wide variety of black folk, and the way in which he spoke truth to power in ways that many black people were not used to speaking in public. White folk were used to conciliatory gestures and the rhetoric of compassion and sensitivity and grace and mercy.
Right.
But Malcolm came rapid-fire rhetoric from Detroit, Michigan, or should I say in Michigan, and he was willing to tell the truth and tell it in ways that were uncomfortable and inconvenient.
Now, you say that you've got four, takes on this man?
Yes,
four
yeah.
visions of Malcolm's life. Can you outline those for me briefly?
Sure. In the scholarship on Malcolm, four different visions emerge, although they interpenetrate at certain points. Malcolm is a kind of revolutionary hero and saint, the figure who is adored and idolized by black nationalists. Primarily. Secondly, Malcolm is a public moralist. This kind of, as Peter Goldman says, a witness for the prosecution against white injustice in behalf or on behalf of black folk who are scorned and ridiculed. Third, Malcolm is Malcolm as a victim and vehicle of what I call psycho-historical forces. So you have the large psychobiographies. What were the domestic influences on Malcolm? What impact did violence have on his subsequent life as a leader? And then finally, Malcolm as a revolutionary figure heading towards socialism. Uh-huh. The Trotskyites in particular argue this line. And while there's some evidence that Malcolm certainly criticized capitalism, I don't think he lived long enough to embrace socialism.
Is there one of these visions that should dominate, that comes to the fore, as it were? Now, part of your agenda is to make this man complex
and
leave the complexities alone.
Yeah.
And yet we love our oversimplifications, don't we, Michael?
That's exactly right, Wayne. I think that in one sense, all of them are legitimate and claims can be made about them. Because I think Malcolm, as you say, the complexity and in some senses the ambiguity of Malcolm is one of his attractive features. I think that the most telling feature of Malcolm's life that I admire most is his willingness to place truth over habit. Here's a guy, when he found the truth, changed his mind. Now, you can't say that about a whole lot of people, especially in that highly visible position, but he was willing to take the risk and inconvenience of growth.
Does he remain a figure, a model of leadership for African-American, particularly for African-American males in the 1990s? Now, again, here's a volatile character.
Yeah. Well, I think so in many ways, although the character of black leadership has changed. I think that as someone has said, we are the leaders we're looking for. The point is that Malcolm and Martin and that generation of leadership made possible the ability of black folk from a wide variety of disciplines, of pursuits, of vocations, and enterprises to become local leaders. So I think he is important.
Should we accept the stereotype, Mike Dyson, of Martin Luther King Jr. on the one side as, well, not to be disrespectful, but bland and sort of passive and the nonviolence. And then on the other side, we have the firebrand of Malcolm X. Is that too simple?
I think so, because Martin Luther King Jr., for the last few years of his life, began to promote aggressive nonviolence. He says, listen, you don't have a job. Go to the White House, jump over the gate, and stay on the lawn. What are they going to do, arrest you and put you in jail? You don't have a job. I think that's pretty aggressive. Malcolm, on the other hand, began to see the inherent radicalism of Martin Luther King Jr. He said, you know, you integrationists are much more powerful than I formerly believed. And Malcolm, as Ossie Davis said in his eulogy, did you ever see Malcolm personally hurt or be violent towards somebody? No.
What about Malcolm X and what a lot of white people take as the threat of black nationalism? You know, we got a separation taken to its extreme. How about that?
Well, I think Malcolm certainly was a separatist at one point of his life. He became a black nationalist, which, you know, different. Black nationalism simply says that black folk ought to control the economic and political and social means by which their culture is created and reproduced, whereas black separatism says they ought to come apart. He participated in to a certain degree in both of those, but I think Malcolm is a symbol of humanism and broad understanding of the complexities of human life.
Let me ask you to comment about black leadership, African-American leadership in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Mike, you wrote a piece for the New York Times in which you took the NAACP to task.
Yeah.
I will leave it to you to explain why you did that. How about it?
Well, I think that black leadership is, in some senses, in crisis, as people like Skip Gates and Cornel West have said. On the other hand, I think that the crisis has to do with the former models of black leadership. Again, we're looking for new models of black leadership in the 1990s. In the 60s, when you had the, you know, boom time character of the economy, folk had money, Lyndon Johnson could dream, and we could talk about a great society. But now, those economic resources have evaporated. The will to compassion has all but gone. And so what we see now is the need to have local autonomous leaderships engaged in various problems around certain ends.
How about the problem of, what shall we call it, infighting? That is to say, the ambiguities of leadership within the African-American community itself.
Sure.
Is there a way around those things, or are they essentially healthy and we just live with them and hope for the best?
I think so. Like the piece I wrote about Ben Chavis, what I was suggesting is that the NAACP had in one sense lost its radical dimensions. Now, people were saying Ben Chavis led them into radical dimensions away from their integrationism. Well, Du Bois was one of the founders.
Right.
That's black radicalism writ large against the canvas of human history. I think that, yes, black leadership, it's necessary for us to fight through these difficulties. We will never have this spurious unity and this alleged solidarity. We can have solidarity, that is, we can organize around specific goals, but black folk, you know, we are socialists, we're rock artists, we're people who love Beethoven and Snoop Doggy Dogg. So there's a wide variety, infinite variety of African Americans, and therefore an infinite variety of leadership is demanded to fulfill the needs and express the desires of that group.
Mike Dyson, your books are Making Malcolm and Reflecting Black. We've been talking about African American leadership at the level of people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, and you mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois. What about for the kid on the street who looks around and says, Bill Cosby, Michael Jordan, gangster rap, Louis Farrakhan?
Sure.
Where is the leadership coming from for the kids who aren't the scholars and who aren't the people who read the New York Times every day? How about that?
Yeah, well, you know, Daniel Boorstin is right that the shift from heroism in the past to celebrity is quite a remarkable shift, and nowhere is that indexed more palpably than in black popular culture. I don't think that's all bad. Folk like Bill Cosby and Snoop Doggy Dogg certainly embody certain values of African-American society, the tradition of oral practice, rhetorical opposition and resistance to forms of oppression, articulating black rage and concern with power. On the other hand, we have to say there must be a relationship between black popular culture in the entertainment aspect and black popular culture like the continued traditions of black rhetoric in the black church, where preachers continue to be powerful embodiments of both the spirit of the community and the will of that community to be better. So I think that When we talk about gangster rap, for instance, here figures like Tupac Shakur or Dr. Dre or Snoop Doggy Dogg, and they run into trouble. But there are many other rappers who haven't. And I'm not suggesting that even, Snoop Doggy Dogg, you know, follow me, follow me, follow me, follow me, but don't lose your grip, because nine trizzies the yizzier for me to mess up stuff. And I ain't holding nothing back. And you know, brother, I got five on a 20 sack. Well, that's all right. But so is the young man who wants to talk about crime and his responsibility of crime in the community. So rap is an extraordinarily complex phenomenon that bears investigation.
You have said that we should look at rap music and gangster rap not because we should attack its weaknesses, but
sure.
We should look to its strengths.
Sure.
Now, Mike, I'm going to look at you straight across the table here and say there's a lot of people who are going to say you're nuts.
They have.
this is a social threat, that there is nothing redeeming to it aesthetically, and there is very little morally to justify it. Now, how about it?
Well, I think aesthetically there's tremendous innovation going on within hip-hop culture. And gangster rap, of course, is only, 6 or 7 years old when N.W.A. came out with Blank the Police, that many black men who were much higher in economic reach and certainly more well-educated blasted out of their windows, including me. The point is that I think gangster rap does express in a very powerful way, the claims and concerns of young black men who have been relatively invisible on one hand and hyper-visible, that is, made to be the image bearers for all that's wrong in American society. So I think we have to deal with it.
You're telling me that we should take with a large grain of salt the confrontational aspect and listen to the message, that's what's really important.
Well, I think in part, yes, because we need to be confronted. The point is, it's not as if before gangster rap came along, white America or black bourgeois America was in different ways concerned about some of the issues that they have raised, especially in mainstream American society. It's not they were standing around saying, let's deal with profound, sophisticated analyses of prevailing forms of oppression. I don't think so. I think what happens then...
That's not exactly the lyric.
That's not exactly the lyric. And the point is that it's not exactly the way in which America treated these young black men. So I think Snoop Doggy Dogg and these other rappers are about, in crude and cruel ways sometimes, putting in our faces things we'd rather sweep under the carpet.
What about the charges of sexism and misogyny? The word bitch comes up quite frequently in rap music. You expect black women, white women, period, simply look at this and say, hey, that's okay.
Sure,
I hear your message.
Of
what about this?
No, I've testified before Congress and the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, and I deplore that. Misogyny and sexism and patriarchy in any form, for that matter, homophobia. But let's not pretend. If we're going to get rid of sexism and patriarchy in American culture, we can't begin with rap music. We got to start with the synagogue. We got to start with the church. We got to start with the temple. We got to start with all of these religious institutions that justify and legitimize the control and domination of women's lives. Listen, it's just like racism. Now, it's true, I don't want the Ku Klux Klan around because they're bad, but it's much more invisible and therefore much more harmful when, you know, people wearing suits and pinstripe suits going to banks harm black people in a larger and more devastating way. So I think it's the same with sexism and misogyny. We've got to deal with them, but let's not pretend that the rapper started that. Gangster rap, rap music is only 15 years old. Sexism and misogyny predate rap by far.
Would you defend gangster rap and rap music, Mike Dyson, on the basis of its politics or on the basis of its aesthetics? Which comes to the fore for you?
Well, both. I mean, the thing about the bottom line for rap music is that you've got to move your behind. And the thing is that they want to, you know, rock the mic and move the crowd.
This is activism.
It's activism in terms of the politics of pleasure. And I think the politics of pleasure mean that you've got to move by the greatest entertainers, even James Brown. After a while, I mean, as Cecil Brown, the essay says, what does mother popcorn mean? I don't know. But when James gets up and says, whatsoever we do, we gonna make it funky. Well, the point is the beat, the voice becomes percussive. It articulates a kind of African-American will to improvisation and rhythm, and there it is. Now, without essentializing black folk, in the same way, I think rap music has tremendous value. When I listen to much of the rap and the tremendous resuscitation of older forms of R&B music, that moves me very powerfully because that's the music of my childhood. So in an aesthetic way, I appreciate it. But also in terms of the politics of culture that are being expressed, both of them work for me.
Now, part of the music of your childhood, Michael Eric Dyson, was the black church.
No question.
Here you are an ordained minister.
Yes.
Let's shift gears a little bit here and talk to me about religion, theology, and African Americans in the 1990s.
Yeah.
One of your teachers at Princeton University, Al Rabiteau, says that the black church is the core of social life for African Americans. Is that still true today?
To a large degree, it is. It's no doubt that the increasing secularization of American culture which is not exempted African-American society, means that people are looking toward other forms and models of leadership, other paradigms of even spiritual insight other than the church. But still, when it's all said and done, the black church is there. It's like what Robert McAfee Brown said. Despite its problems, the black church is like Noah's Ark. If it wasn't for the storm on the outside, you couldn't stand the stink on the inside. The reality is that the black church, despite its problems, sexism, practicing what I call ecclesiastical apartheid, 70% of the black church, especially historically, is constituted of women, and yet they don't have access to the central symbol of power, which is the pulpit. Those are blights, and that's why I say let's not be hypocritical when we look at gangster rap music. On the other hand, the church continues to be the center of emancipatory leadership within our community. It continues to help people who are down and out. It continues to generate social imagination around problems of homelessness and so on. The church continues to be the place where I preach, and where I continue to do my ministry as well.
I'm going to look at you kind of wide-eyed, Mike. Is God black? Is God white? Does it make any difference? Does religion and theology, do those things transcend the boundaries of race? Is there such a thing as black theology, for example?
Oh, sure. I think, and to answer your question more directly, yeah, I think there's such a thing as a black God and a white God and an Oriental. So the point is that...
Now, that's polytheism. Many gods.
No. Let's not get into that debate. No, I believe in one God, but the point is that we don't have access to that God. Leibniz talked about seeing sub specie aeternitatis, which means from the gaze of God. Well, ain't nobody got up that high yet that I know of. So we're seeing from the bird's eye view.
Right.
And that means then that we anthropomorphize. That is, we project up into what God is based on our analogous experience as humans. Now, that means then it's nothing wrong. You know, when I go to churches and I see a white God, that's fine. When I go to, you know, other churches from different cultures and I see God in that way. So why is it a problem, especially for black folk, when I go into a black church and they have a big white Jesus up there? That's cool if we want to be multicultural, but I don't see white folk having a black Jesus in their church. The point is, it's no problem seeing God in your own pigment and hue, as long as it's not limiting and narrowly vicious.
Let me see if I can pick a little fight here with you, Michael. Okay. Eric Dyson. If leadership in social activism and social justice has come in large measure from the black church, why hasn't the leadership with respect to gender equity come from the black church? How do we account for this contradiction?
Well, because the black church, like all the institutions of American society, participate more readily in the American dream than we would like to admit. In other words, the black church is probably more American than we want to concede, like Malcolm was more American than he wanted to concede. And part of what it means then is to be influenced by these large institutions that have shaped our lives. Christianity, no matter the kind of transmutations and transformations black people wrought on it in terms of race, has not caught up in terms of class or especially gender. And I think part of that problem has to do the patriarchal narratives of the gospel and the Hebrew Bible have not been challenged. And they have not been challenged precisely because we thought race was the primordial problem and not issues of gender equity or class strife.
What about the Nation of Islam and the black church in the 1990s, Mike?
Yeah.
Is this a compliment? Is this a threat? How do you view the presence of the Muslims in the black community?
Well, I think they have a powerful ministry. First of all, they deal with young black men, especially who are in prison. They deal with those who need to be rehabilitated, that even traditional Christianity, even African-American Christianity, has not been as successful dealing with.
Well, it's also a question of how they deal with these young people. Are they separating them? Are they bringing us together? What should the issue be that we look at when we view this relationship between Islam and the black church?
Well, I think that what we have to see is that, first of all, they have an alternative black spirituality. They don't mind saying not only is God black, but our God is a black God who loves black people and who is unafraid to back us up when we are calling white racism to responsibility for what it's done.
Is this reverse racism? Is this racism of another form?
Well, that's a loaded question, precisely because you got to have certain amounts of power. I don't believe in that argument. You got to have power in order to be racist, because you can have prejudice and bias. The distinctions are made between that and racism.
Fair enough.
The point is, however, they don't have institutional power to wreck people's lives, but they certainly can express narrow conceptions of racial identity, and I think that goes on. However, the important thing for me about the Nation of Islam is that this alternative black spirituality accents the necessity for black self-regard and love in a way that we don't often find in other narratives religiously or socially.
Let's just pause for a moment and let me really present you with a very large order, Mike. Just give me a quick answer to this. How did you arrive at the sense of self-confidence that I feel just flowing across this table to me?
Yeah.
I mean, that really is at the heart of many of these issues that we're talking about.
Sure. Well, I was no question. I was I was reared in a family that went to the black church. And even though my parents didn't often participate, they sent me. And I came under the influence of Dr. Frederick George Sampson at the Tabernacle Missionary Baptist Church when I was about, 13, 14 years old.
So these are stories about looking back and finding that key person in your life. Where we're letting our youngsters down
today? Sure, it's key persons in terms of mentorship, but it's also institutions. Yeah. I mean, the point is, beyond Dr. Frederick Sampson was a black church there. And listen, I was a teen father. I lived on welfare for 3 years. I didn't go to college till I was 21. Now I'm, 36 years old. I'm, thank God I'm a full professor at a prestigious institution, but I made it for lost time only because I had the impetus and drive afforded me by larger institutions populated by people who didn't have PhDs from Princeton, but who made sure that I got one.
Let's talk about African Americans and education in the 1990s.
Sure.
Michael Eric Dyson, your books are Making Malcolm and Reflecting Black. I want to remind our listeners of those two titles. On the one hand, we have should I create a polarity here? Michael Eric Dyson and then Leonard Jeffries. We have people who are saying that multiculturalism and race in education are polarizing influences or are harmonious influences. Where do African Americans fit into our educational picture?
Well, I think that, first of all, people like Leonard Jeffries are complex as well, so that when he, for instance, served in the New York Board of Education trying to come up with this Afrocentric or at least multicultural curriculum, he was merely pointing out the obvious, that it had been racist and neglected the contributions of women, Native Americans, Latinos, Asians, and so on.
Well, now, he's viewed as an extremist. Do we meet extremism with extremism?
Well, how I would look at it, a kind of Humean causality, I would back up and say, no, there's a difference. We got to deal with the fact that Leonard Jeffries is already responding to something that's present. It's not that he's then creating a response. He's responding to something that's already going on, reducing black folk to invisible participants in the drama of American history. So I think that Leonard Jeffries, even though I argue with Leonard Jeffries, I think his romantic inclinations within black nationalism have to be checked and opposed. At the same time, he does force us to deal with the ways in which black contributions to African-American life and, more specifically, American culture have been neglected and invisible.
Now, when you go into your classes, Mike, at the University of North Carolina over in Chapel Hill, is race the only thing that you talk about?
I mean, of course not.
The accusation is that multiculturalism, Afrocentrism are not really intellectually respectable, that we're not asking our kids to do the heavy work of studying and learning. That what we're doing is just saying to them, you're black, you're cool, therefore your self-esteem has been raised, here's your degree, goodbye.
Right, right.
What about this?
Well, that's nonsense. Being black one-on-one hasn't been taught for years, as it were. And secondly, the reality is they haven't taken classes of me or many of my friends. They haven't sat under the tutelage of people like Nahum Chandler or Juanima Lubiano or Robin Kelly and so on, professors who have integrity, insight, intelligence, who range across a variety of discourses. When you take my African-American studies class, I'm going to talk about Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida, as well as Du Bois. I'm going to talk about post-structuralism and postmodernism, as well as the intellectual incurrence. Not that I have to borrow those in order to legitimize African-American studies. African-American cultural studies stands as a tradition in its own right that has integrity, that has intellectual acuity, and that demands close and repeated reading. I often warn my black students, don't think because of pigment you haven't privileged access to these realities, and I tell white students, don't think this is a gutter course you can come in here and get over. This is serious intellectual work because it's a serious intellectual tradition.
Well, you begin your book on Malcolm X by telling us about a confrontation between you and some young black males.
Sure.
How about it?
Well, these were very bright, very sharp young black men when I was teaching at Brown University, who, for good reasons, I think, in many cases, felt that Malcolm had been commodified and commercialized. His meaning had been circulated viciously within the context of mainstream society, unleashed, as it were, in a way that was problematic. So what I tried to do is to tell them, listen, I understand that, but you don't have a privileged access to Malcolm because you're young, black, and male. Because I, as a young black male, formerly, from Detroit, could lay more claim. And see, you have this Aristotelian regression. It never stops. Well, I was so poor that. No, but I was more poor than you. And then, this litmus test of authenticity doesn't deal with the reality of who and what Malcolm is. So my confrontation was about the politics of authority and authenticity and how black identity is much larger than one thing.
Michael Eric Dyson, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Again, your books are Making Malcolm and Reflecting Black. You look across the spectrum of issues facing African Americans in the 1990s, mm-hmm. religion, politics. You are personally fond of theology and religious studies, feminism, partisanship, all of the political ideologies that float around. My goodness, where do we begin? What issue comes to the fore for you when we speak of leadership in African Americans?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, the enormous crisis introduced by the post-industrial urban collapse of many Rust Belt and other parts, cities in American culture.
Money.
The money, economic structure. A favorite quote of mine is from Dorothy Day. She said, listen, I want to work toward a world in which it's possible for people to behave decently. And when I look at the urban landscape and I see the kind of demonization and pathologization of young black people in these urban centers and increasingly young white people, Generation X and the lost generation. But the interesting thing about me, to me, of course, is that Generation X is are called slackers, whereas the young black folk are lost generation. Interesting dichotomy there. The point is, I think that black leadership needs to deal with that. Secondly, it has to deal with the issue of gender inequity. Thirdly, it has to deal with homophobia. The contributions of gays and lesbians have been all but rendered invisible within the context of black society as the larger mainstream culture. And I think we have to deal with that.
Michael Eric Dyson is the author of Making Malcolm, a study of the life and legacy of Malcolm X. He's also the author of Reflecting Black, a collection of essays about African American culture. An ordained Baptist minister, Michael Eric Dyson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this discussion.
The government will not protect us or defend us or find those who have brutalized us and made us the victims for the past 400 years. Then it is time for us to do whatever is necessary to defend ourselves.
Ain't nothing but a party, y'all. Let's get it on.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest was Michael Eric Dyson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Audio tapes of this program are available postpaid for $10. Our address is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Please ask for program number 751. That's number 751. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. We're also interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week, part four of Soundings for Black History Month 1995. My guest will be the distinguished historian John Hope Franklin of Duke University. John Hope Franklin will be here to talk about the historian's craft, leadership, and African-American culture in the 1990s. Until next week, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.